97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to a Thursday edition of the Mark Reardon Show. We're down a member temporarily. Sue is out for a couple of days. She's taking a trip out to the East Coast. We'll be back next Wednesday. Fred, the Hall of Famer, is here. Ethan's here as well. And we kind of start in a very unusual circumstance with the Lindsey Clancy case because, Fred, as you know, you've been following this. You and I have been throughout the day, and there have been a couple of times where the jury has been in the courtroom. Kevin Reddington, the defense attorney, the attorney that represents Lindsey Clancy, got very angry about something that happened about an hour ago. But we're literally at the point in the day where the jury typically goes home. And we don't know if they're close to a verdict or if they're close to a mistrial, I think, at this point. There was a couple of weird things that happened because he had to ask every member of the jury this morning a question about maybe some contact they had with someone outside of the courtroom and if it affected them in any way. And then they send one juror out, and this becomes several jurors. And there was one theory when Fox was analyzing this about an hour ago that maybe they were switching out an alternate for a juror. And then Kevin Reddington, I'll play, I think we have the audio of his speech because he's pissed. He thinks that there's a juror that is not following the specific instructions from the judge on reasonable doubt. So a lot of confusion in the last couple hours because it looked like maybe they were coming in and a mistrial was going to be declared. Then it was just a conversation with a couple of the jurors, and they sent them back. So we don't know exactly what's happening. What I do know, Fred, is that this is the time of day when things kind of wrap up. You know, this happened yesterday. We were literally in the open. You pointed up at the TV, and they were wrapping things up for the day. They started this morning with normal deliberations. Here's what happened a short time ago.
I just wanted to go over a couple of things this afternoon. First off, I want to remind you that you are required to follow my instructions on the law as I gave them to you. All right. I also want to, at this point, go over the instruction that I gave you about reasonable doubt. All right. And so reasonable doubt. The burden is on the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the charges made against her. What is proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, the term is often used and probably pretty well understood, though it's not easily defined. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all possible doubt, for everything in the lives of human beings is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. A charge is proved beyond a reasonable doubt if, after you've compared and considered all of the evidence, you have in your minds an abiding conviction to a moral certainty that the charge is true. When we refer to moral certainty, we mean the highest degree of certainty possible in matters relating to human affairs, based solely on the evidence that has been put before you in this case.
So the issue and the specifics of reasonable doubt seem to be raised by one juror. Now, I'm going to play Kevin Reddington, the attorney, because he seems to think, and this is where it gets confusing, even more confusing, that the numbers are on his side. In other words, that there is maybe an 11-1 split, and there's one juror that doesn't want to play by the rules and is holding out. But does he feel like he is on the, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity side of that or not? I don't know how he would know that. Fred, I even heard Paul Morrow say he really wouldn't know that. So maybe he's handicapping this on his own.
They said that he's looking at body language with the jurors
when
they come and go.
So then, you know, they had their lunch. Everybody makes the comment. Even Brad Young says, look, they always like to get their one last lunch in. And I thought they were ready to come in and a mistrial was going to be declared, but that did not happen.
I've told you that every person is presumed to be innocent until they are proved guilty, and that the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. If you evaluate all the evidence and you still have a reasonable doubt remaining, the defendant is entitled to the benefit of that doubt and must be acquitted.
So there's a lot of specifics here when it comes to the law, and that's what the judge is trying to point to. Then Reddington gets up there, and he is livid about this.
The court has an instruction from the foreperson of that juror that's been working for a week now, saying that there's one juror who refuses to listen to the law that you've given him or her on reasonable doubt. And I suggest respectfully that the soft instruction that you gave them saying at the sidebar, can you listen to the law as I instruct you, does not focus on the issue. It is the question is not sufficient enough.
Did you hear the word that he used there? He said soft, right? I mean,
yeah.
he took a shot at that judge there. There's no doubt about it.
It does not allow any foundation for a motion to remove the juror who refuses to accept your instructions on the law, on reasonable doubt. And if we come back here in a half an hour with a mistrial because of a juror that has just spurned the instructions of this court, it's a shame. It's a real shame. And that's why I object to the court's ruling. I request that we have further inquiry. I request that my motion is to remove this juror that refuses to listen to your instruction on reasonable doubt.
Okay, so the same thing just happened. Right during that soundbite, Kevin Reddington, that was about from maybe an hour ago, a little bit more than an hour ago, they just sent the jury home for the day. So they're done for the day, but they're still deliberating. So that's kind of interesting. So when the judge listened to Reddington and the arguments about, you know, kicking that juror off, replacing with an alternate. By the way, I asked Phil Holloway this question because I was a little confused. There's 18 jurors, right? There are 9 females, 3 men on the panel, but there are 6 alternates, right? The alternates are not involved in the deliberations up until this point. I asked Phil that question. So they'd have to wouldn't they have to start from scratch when it comes to, you know, deciding the facts of the case. So here's the judge after he rules.
Jurors' parties understand, as they say, the discharge of a deliberating juror is a sensitive undertaking. I was just specifically responding to the specific question that was asked. I don't feel that it is proper for me to side with one side or the other of the deliberations. I don't feel it's appropriate for me to say I agree with one juror or 11. At this point, I've asked if they are able to follow my instructions. According, they swore earlier that they could. They've said tonight at this point that they can. That was specifically addressed towards the specific question.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm doing.
So, you know, I'm not going to criticize the judge here because it seems like he's being particularly cautious when it comes to the procedure. Now, this is where I get a little lost, okay? I got a message from a listener this morning, and here's what it said on this particular case. I listen to you regularly, agree with much of what you say, which is why your comments today really disappointed me. You said the Lindsey Clancy case should be open and shut because we all know who did it, pointing to Lindsey's confession. First of all, I never said that. Fred, you've been listening to me for 3 weeks talk about this case, right? Have I ever said that it is open, shut, and I pointed to a confession?
No.
I don't know that there is a confession because I guess there's not. She points this out. That's precisely the issue. Lindsey did not, this is in all caps, I have to yell this, right? Independently confess according to the prosecution's own testimony. Her acknowledgement came after she had been told what she allegedly did. That's a critical distinction. If she did not independently remember committing these acts, then her later acknowledgement cannot by itself establish that we know who did it. I can't help people like this, Fred. I just can't. That doesn't mean, she says, Lindsey didn't do it. It means the evidence still matters. And actually, whether it proves she didn't could make anyone crazy, stupid, or liberal. I'm not any of those things. I'm actually highly intelligent, emotionally mature, conservative Christian who believes those children deserved a rigorous investigation, and they didn't receive that. My response was, that's just ridiculous, okay? The issue of a confession or anything like that is totally, let me use a legal term here. I'm not an attorney, but I play one on the radio, is moot. It does not matter. We know who committed these crimes. We know that she did it. The only issue is whether she's criminally responsible. It's not whether she killed these kids and strangled these poor kids. Everybody knows that. The prosecution, the defense has admitted that. I went to closing arguments, which, by the way, Kevin Reddington's closing arguments were just terrible. But he admits that she killed these children. That's not even a question. So this person who messaged me, who claims not to be crazy, is crazy. Because you're not looking at the facts of the case and what's at issue. There's not one person, Fred, we've been following this again for weeks. There's not been one person today, yesterday, Monday, last week, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Nobody that I've seen analyze this case has ever questioned whether or not Lindsay Clancy strangled her own children. It's not at issue here. That's accepted. Does the evidence still have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt? Yes. But there's no reasonable doubt that she didn't strangle her kids. It's not the issue here. So how people who claim to be intelligent and mature emotionally can even think that that's an issue. And by the way, then this person responds to me, no doubt with ChatGPT. I give him kudos for using ChatGPT. You need to educate yourself because you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm going to be on the Joe Rogan side of things here because some of this stuff, and I've had empathy for Lindsay Clancy. I really have. But one thing I also know is, you know, if this was a man who did this, and I get that men don't get postpartum, depression, this thing would be over right away. You know, it wouldn't even be a question mark. So here's Rogan. Now, I do think that there's some clarification here that I'll make.
If those ladies could see the crime scene and see those dead kids with their fucking vacant eyes staring up because their mother took their life, the last fucking thing that they saw was their mother standing over them, choking them to death, I don't think they would feel so bad.
I think everybody that's saying free Lindsay.
People are out of their fucking minds.
They should get free. They should have to let her babysit.
She's out of her fucking mind. The world is out of its fucking mind. It's like more of these things come up where you're like, this can't be real. This can't be real. And it is real. More of these things where you're like, people are showing up in support of a woman who killed her children. I don't care how rough it was. The ability to kill your children is crazy. That's a level of crazy that anyone who has kids, you know how much you love them, what you would do to save them, what you do to protect them from harm.
Which, by the way, is exactly why the claim is this was her being in psychosis. And the prosecution says, no, there's ample evidence that she knew what she was doing. The only issue here is the distinction between right and wrong. Everybody knows that Lindsay Clancy, except for Lisa Rinna and some of these kooks out there, and apparently the person who messaged me, that she's the one who killed her kids. That's not the issue at all. So the jury's home. Now I'm starting to think that this mistrial thing might not happen, because if there is only one juror and they didn't send another note and they went home, maybe there's a chance they reach a decision tomorrow morning. Okay, again, just a quick update. The Lindsay Clancy jury, and they came into the courtroom this afternoon because the judge had asked them some questions. They've been sent home for the day. They'll pick it up tomorrow morning. I want to be clear because going on my rant from the opening, I think you can still be empathetic to mental illness and postpartum depression and things that Lindsay Clancy and other moms have gone through. My son's, you know, girlfriend Natalie, who is the mother of my grandchild, had some postpartum depression. It's real, and I know that it's real, but that's a big, big, long distance from strangling all three of your children and not knowing the difference between wrong and right. I've deferred to this jury all along. They heard all the evidence, right? I did not hear all the evidence. What I did hear, and I even reread the closing arguments from both sides just a few hours ago. And again, there's no denying from, you know, Kevin Reddington that Lindsay Clancy strangled her children. That's not part of this case. It's only whether she is criminally responsible if she knew the difference between right and wrong. That's the issue they're trying to decide. My hope is, here's what I think is going to happen. Now, I'm usually wrong about this. I think this jury is hung. I think they're going to declare mistrial. And I think that maybe calmer heads might prevail here, and they cut a deal to not put everyone through this torture again and send her to a facility for the rest of her life, or until she's 70 years old, or whatever the issue is. She should not be free. I'm not arguing that, nor have I ever argued that. But it's just amazing how people have glommed onto this in ways that are totally disconnected from reality. And I think that happens with a lot of high-profile cases, and it's unfortunate. All right, there's my second rant on Lindsay Clancy and the people's reaction. Charles Lipson with us this afternoon, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. I don't even know if you've been following any of this, Charles, but it's been, you know, the last couple of weeks, a lot of attention on this case in Massachusetts.
It's true. My wife and I were actually discussing it today. She's a clinical social worker. You nailed all the issues. I would just say that I would add only one thing to your description of the case, which is that she clearly did a lot of planning. She sent her husband out, a lot of other things, and I don't know whether how that figures into it. Let me tell you what really interests me about this. I am always interested why some particular cases, which in some ways are odd or horrific or whatever, why does some become national issues like this? You can see why Charlie Kirk's murder became a national issue. He was a national figure.
Well, I have an answer for that in this one. Now,
go ahead. I want to hear it. Yeah.
Sometimes what happens, and you know this, it's the news cycles. So for the most part, for 3 weeks of this trial, nobody covered it. But what was happening, you know, underneath the surface is you had people that were showing up outside of the courtroom, women in particular, who were supporting and giving support to Lindsey Clancy in a way that certainly I think many deemed inappropriate. Because again, she's not someone who's not culpable for strangling her kids. She did it, but there was more. I think there was empathy, but there's a lot of women that have overdone it on the empathy, I think, forgetting the horrific nature of this crime. I've even addressed this, and I know the judge addressed this, and even the prosecution. These poor jurors, they've gone through hell here. I can't even imagine psychologically coming out of deliberations, having seen pictures of these young kids, the crime scene, all the testimony, the horrific screams on the 911 call. These jurors are going to be affected for the rest of their lives because of this case.
Have you ever been on a jury?
I never have, but I've been, you know, during the voir dire process a couple of different times, but I've covered, I'd say, 6 or 7 murder cases, a bunch of other trials. In my younger days, I was a news person, Charles, so I would do this in Columbia, Missouri, and I've been in the courtroom a lot, so I've seen opening statements, I've seen closing arguments, I've seen evidence, you know, enter. A lot of times it's very boring in a courtroom because this stuff takes a long time, but I've never served on an actual jury, no.
I have, and it was really interesting. And my mother served on a jury for a murder case when there was capital punishment. But I must say, one of the things that's so interesting about being on a jury is that when you go into that room and close the door, it's just you, the jury. The judge is gone. I mean, the judge has given you instructions, and whatever he or she said, those are the legal rules, and you're supposed to follow them. But, I mean, it's really an interesting. It is democracy in a certain way, guided by the guardrails, supposedly, of the justice system. But it's just a fascinating thing because on our jury, there were people of just, it was the full range. It was both races and people who had a lot of education, people who had very little, people who had very senior employment, people who had sort of ordinary jobs. I mean, it was just so fascinating.
Well, I was thinking about this morning along those lines. I've been thinking about this the last couple of days. There's really nothing else like this in our entire system. I mean, lawmakers go into a skiff to hear, you know, sensitive information about national security, things like that. We know that there are closed door rooms, but this is such a unique system that we have with juries. To your point, the judge doesn't know, the attorneys don't know. We'll really never know outside of what these jurors let us know after this case, what really happened in that deliberation room. And of course, I'm sure you've seen the great movie. I don't think the remake was as good, but 12 Angry Men.
And
12 Angry Men, one of the best movies ever made, by the way, if you want to see a movie about jury deliberations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, they don't have this in France or Germany it only happens in common law countries, England, and the United States, and maybe a few others. But I mean, it's a treasure, really, that in the end, on very serious cases, ordinary people guided by the law get to decide.
It's kind of
what our system is and should be.
And I think, you know, my experience with juries, and I think this is happening here, is these people take it very seriously. They really do. And they're trying to do their jobs. And I think they're going through a lot. We got to get some other stuff in here. I'm going to talk to Jacob Olodort here in a few minutes about Iran. It was J.D. Vance, the vice president, who did the briefing today. Carolyn has, you know, given that gig up. We don't know if there's going to be a replacement or just cabinet members. But, of course, he's asked about Iran and the economy.
We've been quite successful up to this point. Gas, frankly, could have been much, much higher were it not for our efforts. But I'm not going to make a promise about when it's going to return to $3. What I will say is that we have to remember, why are we doing this? Number one, it's so that Iran never has a nuclear weapon. And number two, what we're doing right now is protecting commercial shipping in order to ensure that we don't have a worldwide energy crisis.
So look, those answers for me are not good enough. And I'll tell you what happened this morning as I was taking my little baby kitten, Charles Smokey, to get his manhood taken away from the vet. Kind of a sad day. Going to have to, you know, grieve that tonight. But I was looking at the gas station prices, and we're back up to $4 a gallon here in Missouri. And that's in Missouri. So that's pretty high, because elsewhere it's higher because of the taxes. And this whole, you know, administration take that it was higher during the Biden administration, I don't care about that. I've predicted for 3 months now that these gas prices were not going to come down. Guess what? I've been told by the administration they're going to come down. I've been told by President Trump they'd be down by now. I've been told by listeners they'd be down by now. They're not, and they're not going to. And people need to accept that. And Republicans need to accept culpability on that when it comes to these midterms.
I think that's right. I think Trump made a mistake when he allowed this long pause to begin. That was they had several more weeks of targets. I think that we will win this war. That is, I think we can outlast that regime. I am not sure we can stand up a successor regime without a lot of internal violence in the country. I suspect that the CIA is now beginning to arm dissident groups within the country. And it is striking to me that the Iranians have declined to attack Israel in this latest round, because they know that Israel is not playing tiddlywinks. They will come in and do real damage to the leadership of that regime.
Why aren't we doing real damage to the leadership of that region? I mean, this is the part that's frustrating for me, because even under the scenario that you're talking about, and by the way, I would accept that. I think the president was asked about the CIA. He's not going to give that up. We're not going to tell the world what we're doing here. But in the end, if that's the plan, you know this, Charles, that is a long-term proposition. That's going to take us past the start of this war, like into next year and beyond. That's not something that gets tidied up here in, you know, 9 or 10 weeks.
You could well be right. It's funny, though, regimes like not only like Iran, but any regime that falls, it doesn't bend like a tree, which bends more and more, and you can see it's almost about to break. It breaks like pressure on a glass table. You see more and more pressure, and then all of a sudden it breaks. And so it's just hard to tell. But it is almost inconceivable that that the regime there will break without what they call kinetic action. That is, there has to be guns on the street, and or there has to be an inability to pay the internal forces of repression. As soon as those are unwilling to fire on the people on the street, then more people will come out on the street, and it becomes a cascade.
I hope you're right. Look, that's the scenario that I hope. I hope this comes from within. That would be the best, you know, situation. But again, it's not going to be wrapped up quickly. I hope you have fun plans for Labor Day weekend. It's hot here in St. Louis, so you're probably better off if you're not here. But enjoy your weekend, Charles.
I appreciate that. It is going to be a no-labor weekend for me.
I like the sound of that for sure. On the topic of Iran, the president said this yesterday.
Took out all of the new equipment that they tried to build along the Strait of Hormuz. Some defensive, some offensive. We're taking out a lot of ships. They can't see it because they have no radar, because we blew it up. And we blew up much more than their radar last night. It was a very heavy attack last night. And we're prepared to do another one anytime we want.
Now, we were talking about this, Charles Lipson and I, a few minutes ago, talking about, you know, what will the Iranian people do? Will some regime change be organic from within? I think that's the hope. It has been the hope. Here's what he says about that.
As of 3 months ago, they had 52,000 protesters were killed. Can you imagine this, fellow? And now I hear the numbers probably 20,000, 25,000 more. They have close to 65,000 protesters killed. The only answer is that they're being shot. The regime is getting weaker and weaker by the day. And at some point, they're not going to be able to shoot so easily because I think the people aren't going to take it.
Yeah, Jacob Olodort is back with us, Chief Research Officer, Director of the American Security at the America First Policy Institute. Jacob, how are you? Welcome back this afternoon. Glad to have you.
Mark, thanks so much for having me. Always a privilege to join you.
We know. I think we have pretty good indication here that the economy in Iran is collapsing. People are having, you know, a tough time. You can't buy maybe the food and the fuel that you need. Prices have gone way up. Even the armed forces can't be paid, we're hearing, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean political collapse, and the regime is hanging on here. So when it comes to the next steps in this particular war, what do you expect? Because it seems, and the president was even asked this directly yesterday, is the CIA involved with, you know, arming some of the dissidents? And he's not going to tell people that. I think there's a hope that that's happening right now. But again, that's more of a longer term proposition. It doesn't seem like the economic sanctions and the pressure are leading to the results in the short term that we're interested in. But I want your take on that.
Well, look, obviously, this is not something that's going to happen overnight, nor should it. This is a regime that's created redundancies, that's created a lot of, that's really designed to suppress any type of internal opposition. And in fact, the new recruits into the political leadership there are precisely from those elements in their security state and elsewhere that have that. But it also means they have far less acumen about doing anything else, which means they don't know how to govern, they don't know how to manage the economy, much less to figure out their response to the attacks that they're facing now. So I think, you know, you're not seeing a different country, perhaps, in the way that most people might think about it overnight, but I don't think that was the expectation all along either. I mean, this is a generational change, and this is really ending 5 decades of terror that has been designed by this regime.
So, and I agree with that, by the way, and I hope that that's where we're heading. But do you think that in the end, what happens here, because we don't know how this all finishes up and how stubborn they might be and who takes over, and, you know, it's very confusing. But if you don't have a situation where, and my previous guest kind of referred to it as kinetic action, where you have riots and bullets from rebel groups or resistance from, you know, ordinary citizens and a regime that is unable to suppress the domestic opponents. I think we all kind of hope that something like that happens so we don't have boots on the ground. Is that, in your view, still a realistic possibility moving forward?
Well, look, I mean, what it looks like will depend, right? I mean, that's kind of what it looks like in the movies. And, you know, obviously, there have been many historical events where that's taken place in that manner. But, you know, this is a very different type of regime. It's a huge country. And it's created, again, a lot of internal elements to suppress repression, not to mention still contingencies, very small ones, albeit proportionally, of supporters. And so, and it has an external terror proxy network. This is kind of unlike any other change in regime or any other maybe future of governance that we've seen in other in history. And so I think but also that's not really the U.S. priority here at the end of the day. The U.S. objective is to get it to a weak enough state where it cannot harm the American people and its own people. And so that, I think, is, as you've alluded to at the top, is a long ways away, as a long ways there,
but,
that direction.
But here's one of the difficulties, Jacob, that I have. If you go back, it seemed very clear that Trump didn't want, even though he kind of started talking about, you know, bombing the bridges and the water plants and stuff like that, he didn't want to affect the, you know, the people of Iran that are just victims of themselves of this regime. But he also was hoping for a deal, and there seemingly were back channels that were working. You don't know if you're talking to the right people, but there was always hope for a deal. I heard the president say yesterday that, you know, there's no deal, right? I think he pretty much admitted we're not going to get a deal here. He believes the IRCG is controlling the government. They don't want a deal. So why would we even try to get a deal at this point? I mean, that's not going to happen. Is that realistic at all?
Well, I, of course, have no unique visibility. I don't speak for the president and his team. But, you know, he's always also said, in my understanding, that it's either a deal, we do it a diplomatic way as an outcome, or militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, it could have also just been a diplomatic tool to encourage a deal, again, a good deal. It has to be the right deal that makes sense to the American people. We had the MOU. That was not the final deal. That was to set the parameters for establishing that. Clearly, Iran was the one who violated those parameters, as it has been doing, by cutting off international traffic through this waterway, which is we've talked about, core tenet of you know, international relations. And so, so I think we are where we are because of Iran's actions, but I think we're in a much better place consistently than we have been for months. And so we're getting, you know, the prices have stabilized in a record number of time. You know, the traffic is moving through the waterway, 10 million barrels a day, I've read. So, you know, while Iran, while pressure is on the regime, and so all everything seems to be stabilized and actually, you know, as good as we can be as far as global effects when we're trying to use military action to stop a threat.
Is it? It's a little weird to me that, you know, when all this started, we were given the videos of what was getting, you know, blowed up and all that stuff. And I know that we're targeting, you know, facilities or whatever maybe the targets are, but we're not seeing that visual. I'm not saying that they're lying about any of this. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying we don't see that visual evidence. And I don't know that that helps with, you know, promoting the case for this war.
Well, the case the president made, and I think the case is one that the American people understand as far as the longest standing threat. You know, I think it's the nature of news to report things that are, well, newsworthy. And unfortunately, when you succeed, much like the first month after Operation Epic Fury, there was little talk of how historic, how truly important that military operation was. But that's the nature, I think, sometimes of news reporting, is that you talk about the non-successes rather than successes.
Well, yeah, that does happen. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Some of this is through the filter of the legacy media, and I, more than anyone else, I understand that. Jacob, thanks for coming on. Always great. I hope you have some nice Labor Day weekend plans. Enjoy yourself. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Edward.
All right. Man, I got the most awesome soundbite from Ryan Reynolds, where he just sounds like a complete idiot. And I like Ryan Reynolds, too, but he was on a red carpet somewhere talking about the decade of the 80s, and it's actually rather entertaining. We'll get to that before Sue's News. Ethan's going to handle Sue's News this afternoon. You know, it's funny because JT Miller was in town. Is it JT Miller? The comedian. And I'm thinking about this. I can't remember his name. Help me out, Ethan, in the other room, because I can't remember. TJ Miller. That's it. I was doing the background. TJ Miller, who was in the Deadpool movies with Ryan Reynolds. And then he became kind of, by the third one, I think he was in the second one, became persona non grata because of some issues on set that he was accused of. I don't know. There might have been some Me Too moments. But when TJ Miller was in the studio about a month and a half ago, he's sitting here across from me, and he looks up at the TV screen, which is to my right, and there's literally a Mint Mobile commercial on with Ryan Reynolds. And I'm not going to bring up Deadpool or Ryan Reynolds when I'm in the studio with him doing the interview, but he actually brings it up. He goes, oh, there's the Mint Mobile guy. And I had to explore it. We went down the Ryan Reynolds rabbit hole just a little bit. He probably said some more things about Ryan Reynolds and his relationship with him than he had said in a long time. And it was just sort of weird because it happened because the Mint Mobile commercial came on. So that was kind of interesting. But Ryan, look, what he said was more comical, I think, than anything. He's not in trouble in any kind of way. But I'll play that. We'll get to that after 4 o'clock. And I swear to God, I've had this story for days about the $500 toothbrush from Dyson. And I got to get that in here at the beginning of the hour. Here's a nice little local story that I thought was interesting. This caught my attention in a clickbait way earlier this afternoon in our local paper. The headline is former GM sues Lombardo's restaurant, says he was fired over a Charlie Kirk Facebook post. And he was, because he should have been. So he should have been. Here's the story. The Post has it this way. A former restaurant manager is accusing his employer of wrongfully terminating him over a Facebook post he made last year about the shooting death of political activist Charlie Kirk and the Second Amendment. Michael T. Mormino of Edwardsville filed a lawsuit against Lombardo's restaurant this week. They go into Lombardo's across from the airport. Is a family-owned Italian eatery that began in 1934. They talked about how the sister restaurants are at the Union Station and Carmine Steakhouse near the Arch, down by where I used to work when KMOX was down there. So on September 10th of 2025, last year, we're about at the one-year anniversary of Charlie Kirk's assassination. This kid makes a post on his personal Facebook account. I guess he's a guy. Does it say his age here? Because he's coming off as a kid. I don't see an age here. He makes a post on his personal Facebook account referring to the death that day of right-wing political activists. This is the Post-Dispatch language. Charlie Kirk. Kirk was shot in the neck on stage during an event at the Utah Valley University in Utah. The Post read, so this is what he does on Facebook, couldn't happen to a bigger piece of blank except maybe one I can think of. How's that Second Amendment treating you now? Okay. Now, we saw a lot of these a year ago, and they were disgusting and sick. So the paper writes it up this way. The Post was intended to be political commentary on Kirk's previous statements on school shootings and the Second Amendment, a citizen's right to keep and bear arms, the suit reads. The Post did not mention Lombardo's, the restaurant, or any coworker or any customer. They say Mormino did not write the post on company equipment, this is what the lawsuit says, on behalf of Lombardo's or on the restaurant's Facebook page. And he did not direct it to anyone connected to the business. It was personal political speech on his own Facebook account, which, by the way, I'm not disputing that. I don't think a judge is going to dispute that. I don't know how you can dispute that. It is personal political speech on his own Facebook account. But it was reprehensible, and it was disgusting, and it was cheerleading the assassination of someone, which was disgusting. So you do have, look, I've got a clause in my contract. There are things that you can do. Diana Rossini found out that the hard way at The Athletic. And by the way, there's some interesting reporting about her in the follow-up to that controversy with Mike Vrabel today. But Fox 2 did a story on this, I guess, last week, and it says that Mormino was repeatedly asked to remove references to his employment from his Facebook if he intended to make political posts. Lombardo also said that based on timestamps, Mormino made the post about Kirk while clocked in at work. He started working for the restaurant in 2010. He became the GM of Lombardo's. The story says he was a reliable employee, never received a written warning, written discipline, suspension, or demotion. Who cares? That doesn't matter at all. Says they never documented any concern about his work performance, honesty, treatment of customers, supervision of staff, or management of the restaurant. Okay, that's all good too. So the wrongful termination suit says that he was fired over his political beliefs, which violates Missouri's law. As a result, he suffered and will continue to suffer damages. So, I addressed this and put this out on the X, formerly Twitter, today because I think people should pay attention to this case. And, I think I even stated at the time, I wasn't crazy about going after every person in America that tweeted about this and forcing them to lose their jobs. Because if you remember at the time, look, Libs of TikTok and the site End Wokeness, they certainly did quite a job. And they continue to do so when people say, when teachers say things that are reprehensible or they're cheerleading on the Alphabet Mafia. Libs of TikTok will post some things that get a lot of attention. People lose their jobs, right? There are consequences for your actions. So the headline again at the Post, just in case you see it today, said former GM Sue's Lombardo's restaurant says he was fired over a Charlie Kirk Facebook post. My headline, they haven't changed it yet. My headline is better. Crazy leftist restaurant GM spews hate and cheers on the death of Charlie Kirk and now whines about getting fired for despicable behavior. I think that's a better headline, and I have no empathy for this guy at all. We're going to come back. I'll give you the details. I know you've been waiting all week for the $500 toothbrush. We've got a couple other things I want to handle as well. Ethan's going to do Sue's News. She's off for a few days. She'll be back next week. And then we got Phil Holloway. He'll give you the very latest on the Lindsey Clancy trial. Interesting developments today, but the jury has gone home for the day with no deliberations left this afternoon and no decision and no verdict, but no mistrial.
Get more at 971talk.com.